Before going to question period, first of all, I will call the speakers of the second session to come in the front here for a question period. And also, Mr. Ali Abu Sabah, I've asked to be able to talk and give a little presentation for about 2 minutes on the subject of the second part of the conference. Is he in the room? Yeah. So I invite him to come in.
Thank you so much for accepting to accommodate a short intervention, but I felt given the kind of issues that we have been hearing since yesterday, it may be important to share with you a piece of information about some ongoing work by the African Development Bank. I think through the 2 days there were the issue of water resource mobilization, provision of irrigation, that sort of thing has been raised quite a number of times. And we in the African Development Bank felt that this is one area that the bank can actually make some specific contribution drawing on our comparative advantage in the provision of infrastructure. So we have built on a piece of joint work that was done by the African Development Bank, the World Bank, IFAD, FAO, and the IMI, which basically looked at the entire performance of the sector across the continent and came up with a very strong and very credible assessment of the various categories of countries with regards to their policy environment, level of preparedness, capacity to develop irrigation, potential for development of irrigation, and so on and so forth. So we felt that moving forward, and especially in light of the renewed interest in increasing and scaling up support to agriculture, that the bank would put together a business plan for water mobilization that would have a continental perspective. So we have developed a sort of a plan that takes into consideration the kind of classification that was done under this previous piece of work and went ahead to identify in certain number of countries specific interventions, whether it's for the construction of large dams, medium dams, even water harvesting structures, and certain other countries where the potential for irrigation development exists. And we have put together a process of an assessment of what it takes to actually get some of these operations into implementation, whether they require some social studies, environmental impact assessments, project preparation, detailed design, and we have consolidated the entire thing into what we call a business plan. The expected and the required financing to actually bring this whole thing into being is in the order of about $5 billion over a 3 years period, actually over a 5 years period, but 2 years will actually be project preparation because it requires a lot of upstream work. Now, this is obviously something that the African Development Bank cannot support by itself. It has to work with partners like yourselves to be able to mobilize the necessary funding. But we felt it's quite important to put all of this information together into one piece to facilitate the resource mobilization. Now, the objective of this business plan is basically to mobilize about 16 billion cubic meters of water in terms of storage. So this will have a very strong contribution in terms of the potential for food production. We estimate that about an area of about 500,000 hectares of land could be irrigated under this business plan, and the additional water mobilized will have the potential to irrigate additional 850,000 hectares of land. This is, of course, in addition to the potential for hydropower generation, which will be looked into on case-by-case basis, and additional potential for provision of rural water supply simply because of the availability of the additional water to be stored. So we look forward to work with all the partners present in this room, and hopefully at a later stage we'll have an opportunity to share and have more technical discussions with those who are interested. Thanks to McGill University again for giving us the opportunity to share this information with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We now have a question period of about 25 minutes at the most. I would like people who are interested to ask questions to go to the mics. I remind you that we would like you to present yourself and the organization you belong to. So I'll give the first round to you.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Laure Verhidel. I'm a natural eco-sociologist and a columnist as well. So thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. First, I think it's good to remember that the main cause of anger is not due to a lack of food, but a lack of justice. And I think that this fact is not sufficiently addressed in general when we talk about investment and the way our economy has been financialized at many level. I think we really need a shift of paradigm in order to address the needs of the people rather than the needs of the market at the first place. And I think that the idea of going more and more into food sovereignty policy is really not only a need but a necessity. So it goes into that need of a shift of paradigm. Now my question is linked to that financialization of our food system and the fact that we've seen more and more holders and large corporations buying important pieces of land in Africa, but also on other continents. And I would like to, and that's seen as an investment, actually, although it has a very negative impact on food sovereignty, as we can already see at different levels. So I'd like to see your perspective on that and how we can address it more globally. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think this question is not addressed to anybody in particular, so feel free to answer those who have something to say. Not all at the same time.
So, look, just very briefly, the lady refers to the question of what in English is sometimes referred to as the land grabs. And I think that this was also addressed at yesterday's lecture at 5 o'clock. And I think that the land grabs, I mean, I don't know if it's a good term, but basically we're talking here about foreign investment in agriculture. And foreign investment is basically an important thing. It can be an important motor for development. The issue when it comes to foreign investment for the purpose of producing food in land-rich countries, such as certain stretches of Africa, then there has to be a code of conduct in terms of how these investments are being handled. There has to be benefits to the local population and so on. And I think that we can discuss this, but basically I would not outright dismiss foreign direct investment in agriculture. I do want to stress what I've just said. There have to be arrangements that leave benefits and don't undermine food security at the local level. The other point with respect to the question of food sovereignty, again, I think that we should not underestimate the need for open markets if at the same time we are interested in food security. The exporting or surplus countries that in 2007 and 2008 introduced export restrictions such as, well, you know who they are, Argentina, Kazakhstan, India for rice, and so on, practiced food sovereignty, right? It came at a big cost to their importing clients. Those were starving their neighbor policies.
Thanks. Any other comment from our speakers?
Merci, Madame Varidel, de votre question. Couple of things, maybe when we talk about value chain approaches, basically if you take it from a rural producers organization perspective, then the value chain approach is a question of economic justice at each step of the chain. The other comment I would make, because I didn't have time to do it before, is the issue of climate and climate adaptation. Of course, if you have the rural farmers organization, the force of rural farmers, especially women, organized, then the issue of adaptation is much easier managed because you have a reach to the organizations instead of only individuals.
Thank you very much. Maybe a last comment?
I think that, I mean, you said that
to address the needs of people and not the market. And I think everyone in this room is interested in addressing the needs of people. But particularly from a foreign perspective, I'm not talking about the political perspective of political actors within specific countries, but from a foreign perspective, one of the things we can best do is to help markets empower people, or to empower people to use markets. And markets are not by nature things that are particularly equalitarian. So and you mentioned producer organizations, but there are many other things that can sort of level the playing field. And I think sometimes we get more traction, particularly as foreigners, if we really concentrate on that. That'd be my personal reaction to your question.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to cut the discussion there. I think that we could talk for hours about that very important and very pertinent question, but there's many people that are waiting at the mics. So I will go with Sir there.
About aquaculture, and this is addressed to the gentleman that spoke about water harvesting. And the question was, are you considering also using your storage areas to farm fish or aquatic shellfish plants? And if not, why not? And the other part of that is water for irrigation is a flow-through system. Whereas if you were to recirc your water and use hydroponics, you could grow your fish and your plants and recirculate that water over and over again and have an ongoing renewable use of it rather than just irrigation. But not to say that doing both isn't the best application.
Yeah, the water harvesting structures found in Ethiopia or in the region are usually used for not for fishing or not complemented with fishing because of some specific reasons. But there is a potential for fishing to go with it, to go along with it. But the problem is the local condition doesn't allow you to circulate the water. Water is harvested. The rain season is in 3 months. All the rain falls in June, September. Then this water harvesting, this is the water to be harvested. So there is no possibility to refill the tanks or the ponds after this rain season is gone. So every we need to wait at least 1 year or the next rainy season to fill up the tanks. So mostly, the harvested water is used for gardening at the household level, and it's earning them a good return.
Agricultural specialist, Mushtaq Ahmed, with agriculture specialist with CEDA AGDI. My thanks to all at the high table for their excellent presentations. But my questions relates more to Christopher Delgado, Michael Hamp, and Mario Renaud. When Michael Hamp spoke about the agriculture and fragile states, I think he didn't mention how to engage there. There is a good document on OECD DAC, fragile states, and good donorship issue. And CEDA and other donors are actually working in the most strongest volcano of all in Afghanistan, in southern Sudan, in Haiti, in Afghanistan through the BRAC, one of the southern international NGOs, the civil society organization, and other AGBAR, the Afghan Relief Coordination Agency. There has been a big progress and engagement because we cannot allow these people to fall through the cracks. These people have to be fed. They have to make progress even in the worst of scenarios. So there is a progress made in some terms in feeding those people. They're not there and taking some action in those areas. So there is a way forward. The UN Sustainable Development Division based in Vienna is trying also hard and working there in Afghanistan to move the illicit agriculture to the more regular ones from poppy culture to something else, and they have made some little bit of success there. So there are ways forward in those areas. And with respect to climate, Delgado does make a reference to climate issue with the World Development Report 2008, but 2010 climate change and development, which tries to put climate proofing of agriculture at the center, which talks about act now, act locally, and to move forward. So these messages are very critical at this stage. And with respect to Mario Renaud, civil society organizations, you are, as a Canadian, the civil society has been at the center of the Canadian development endeavors. And we have been able to take forward civil society causes and engage them in all the arenas of developmental cooperation and new dialogue that has been happening. And in fact, in the CADAP and other areas, the producer organizations and the civil societies, we are trying to saturate them with the work so that there is an ownership issue there, that they are actually part of the solution, because the rural CSOs are spatial because of their very diverse nature. They're scattered, so they have to be sort of linked in the national priorities, in the policy setting. So that's an important area that we think we can move forward on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we can go in the same order, if you want.
Thank you very much for that statement and question, which relates to work for agricultural development in fragile states. To give you one example of IFAD's work in fragile states, which stands for a number of examples, but this is one of the more recent ones. Since you have mentioned Afghanistan, and I was part of the design mission quite recently, on a new grant investment, something like $13 million US dollars, for a program called Rural Finance and Livelihood Development Program, which is mainly through the partnerships of microfinance institutions under the umbrella of MISFA. MISFA stands for Microfinance Support Facility, and livestock development, mainly building on the groundbreaking work of FAO done, including in the dairy sector. You have mentioned in particular BRAC. BRAC is one of the active members when it comes to graduation programs. So this is before rural financial services start. It is really working with poorest households in remote areas where they are trained in becoming bankable, so to say, financial literate, and assets are transferred to start up micro business activities. And I think we have not yet seen the implementation. We are at the final stage of the design, but I'm very much convinced that it will succeed, and that it probably also becomes an example for other countries where the environment to work in is more difficult than in others. Thank you.
On climate change, to Mustaq, I didn't get into it too much because I think we have a whole session on it, as we should, but just briefly, I mean, much of the discussion about climate change that one sees in the developed world is about mitigation, which is primarily an issue for the developed world and maybe some of the emerging countries. And it's primarily an industrial issue, not exclusively, but adaptation is critical for the poor developing, largely agricultural countries. And we're really not doing enough. I mean, you can easily see scenarios, as you know very well, where in Bangladesh or Vietnam or countries like that, where large sections of the country are underwater. Just generally in the tropical zone, with the variation in rainfall, either too much or too little, that is likely to be associated with climate patterns going forward, there are tremendous implications, up to 50% yield decrease in some of the semi-arid tropics. I mean, this is a huge issue, and it's just unfortunately the debates around mitigation so often tend to overcome and marginalize the even more important adaptation discussion.
Thank you. Monsieur Renaud?
Yes, maybe briefly. Civil society is is a term that regroups a whole array of representational organizations. If we're talking about public assistance for development effectiveness, the Declaration of Accra in 2008 now gives full legitimacy to civil society groups organized to be not only a recipient or a dialogue as an actor with national and international institutions, but civil society now want to be a part of the action. They want to be part of the definition of development plans. They want to be part of the decision-making process. So if we are talking about the rural farmers' organization as a force, and as I was saying, giving equitable access to market, things are going to be changed rapidly. It's the same thing with the necessity to adapt our behaviors for climate change.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Sir?
Hello. My name is Lazare. I currently work for Equitaire, which is a Montreal-based NGO. And my question concerns the private sector and this insertion into value chains, which seems to be a hot topic for several organizations. Mr. Ferronia mentioned that the private sector is good at commercializing products and good at invested billions in feeding the world. But in my experience, which as you can tell by my age is perhaps a bit shorter than everybody else is in this room, but nevertheless, what I've seen is that the private sector is mostly good at feeding itself. Whether it feeds people tends to be up in the air. The kind of involvement that's been seen in certain kinds of value chains is to invest a lot in production and remove food from the food shed and go commercialize it elsewhere, so that people who actually work in any given food shed see their food security jeopardized, even though we've increased productivity or whatnot. And also because of I'm thinking of a particular case in Central America where I was working, where I think you had a survey in India that about 14% of respondents declared that the main source of information was the private sector. Well, I think in our sample it was about 80% got their information about agricultural practices from agrochemical suppliers, from the input suppliers. And they were using the most unsustainable practices ever, going completely against the recommendations of all of the governmental development agencies and agricultural development agencies. So the concept of justice within the value chain was mentioned, and now I'm wondering how do you actually integrate it, perhaps more specifically for Mr. Hemp and IFAD. Does IFAD, since they finance a lot of value chain style development, is there a kind of way to figure out what is a value chain that actually promotes food security and which ones don't? And perhaps more generally for the rest of you, Mr. Renaud, you already mentioned that a bit, but how do you think justice can be inserted into the value chains? Thank you.
Thank you. Who wants to start? Go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you also for that question. IFAD has a targeting policy to make sure that we really target and really have an impact on the level of what is IFAD's target group, poorest of the poor, poor people in remote areas, women and youth. In the value chain approach, this targeting policy becomes very crucial, because we do not simply follow the interests of the processors, the private company. We do it the other way around. We start with a target group, and we have a sort of a tender process for private sector players, the processing companies, then showing interest in working with these primary producers and to link up and to build partnerships with them. In some cases, we look into already existing partnerships when it's concerning higher value crops, coffee production in Yemen, for instance, and so on. But always with a focus that the impact and the attribution is clear through the investment of IFAD has a positive impact on the target group. So this is mainly the entry point in value chain development in the design of these kind of investments. And then, of course, there are semi-annual supervision missions that, of course, not any deviations from the original plan of this kind of public-private partnership. A public-private partnership and partnerships with primary producers is still on track.
Somebody else.
So, what is a value chain that promotes food security? Good question. And I think that it is a question that has been addressed by the panel. A value chain that promotes food security is a value chain whereby the farmer is enabled to produce up to levels of productivity that enable a livelihood, and at the same time is able to sell produce at prices that are remunerative. And that requires, in the end, markets that function. And I think that is something that I have heard the panel say in different versions. Now, smallholders are there and are smallholders because many of them don't have alternatives, and economic development requires a number of things, including an intensification of agricultural production and markets that function on the input side and the output side, and a transformation of the economies as a whole, whereby in time, through urban pull, as has been exemplified in recent times very clearly by China, there is an ability for economic diversification, enabling many farmers also to move on. But the question of the value chain, I do not think that the NGOs, I do not think that you can have sustainable value chains that are run by the government, it has been tried, or that are run by the not-for-profit sector exclusively. What is necessary to get markets going at what some have called in this panel and in the previous panel, the lower end of the market, which is smallholders, are partnerships where NGOs can play an extremely important role.
Thank you very much. I just, if you don't mind, we'll stop there because I just have enough time for two more questions. And, oh, what a coincidence, there's two people at the mic. So if you can keep it short, if it's possible, as for the asker and the answerers. So, sir, it's your turn.
Thank you. Ken Fachon, and my question is for Mr. Delgado. Just quickly, we've heard about the need to develop institutions, rebuilding agricultural extension services. There was a slide from Mr. Hamp that showed how just the lack of investment by governments themselves in agriculture and rural development on average. And then there was your slide about the global food crisis response showing that 49% of that money had gone to budget support. So I'm wondering, in a situation of degraded capacity to deliver for the rural poor and farmers, how that money that's gone in at the top as budget support has made its way through to help those that are most in need, and if you could perhaps talk to the extent to which that money is traceable and has delivered results. And then on the longer-term development side, you passingly made reference to the enabling environments, and yet that strikes me as absolutely key to delivering food security. And I'd just like to link that with an earlier question about international land grabbing. That is a subject that deserves attention and thankfully is getting some, but it's actually dwarfed by land grabbing at the national and local levels. I mean, just think Cambodia, Zimbabwe, China, you know, where agricultural land is grabbed by those in political power, either for themselves or to reward political cronies or favored industries. And basically the rule of law to defend land tenure is absolutely essential to protect the rights of smallholders and agriculture in general. And so I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk a bit more about what the bank is doing on the enabling environment front. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, thanks, Ken. It is true that in sub-Saharan Africa, at the same time as donor investments in agriculture fell, as you saw from, I think, IFAD slide, that in fact in sub-Saharan Africa had always done less, if you like, than other developing regions on things like ag research, and partly because maybe they felt there was more to do and there were smaller countries and so forth. But it is true that in sub-Saharan Africa there was about 4% at most of national budgets of public expenditure was going to agriculture. Now, having said that, it's turned around quite a bit, and particularly in the CADEP program, there's a lot of emphasis on increasing countries' own efforts, and there are now, I think, four, if I'm not mistaken, countries that are up to the 10% benchmark of public expenditures on agriculture. Now, the key is to get it better, not just more. And one of the things donors have not done is really invest nearly as much in increasing that capacity to actually understand public investment. I happen to be a U.S. citizen, and I regret greatly that USAID puts most of its aid off budget. I don't know about Canada, but it's really aid should be on budget, and people have to be trained to monitor it, and you have to be able to go out and do surveys to know what impact is, and to have results-based monitoring, which is absolutely vital to aid effectiveness. You have to start with the government's own expenditures. This is absolutely essential. One of the small hats I wear is that we actually have an ARD, a partnership with DFID on improving agricultural public expenditures. It's really a small potatoes thing, but fortunately the Africa region of the World Bank is taking this over and greatly expanding it, because we need, as donor partners, and it's not just the banks. I mean, I think IFAD is interested in this, and other partners is to FAO and others, get involved in really training people to understand what's in a budget and where it's going and why the outturns, why it's not getting spent and so forth. So sorry, a bit long, but this is something I really believe in passionately.
Thank you very much. Before going to the last question, I have just a small reminder for you. We've been talking about food and especially lack of it and all morning, so you probably are all getting hungry. I want to tell you, you don't have to escape the room. This lunch will be served at your table as soon as we're done with the question period. So go ahead.
Thank you. Luc Mougeot du CRD. I'd like to refer to a statement by Mr. Ferroni, hinting at the demand side of the food security equation, saying that by producing more, obviously you make food more affordable to people. And one of the challenges, of course, is to increase the yield growth rates that have been declining. One of the responses have been to use proprietary improved seeds. Some observers would say that response is not so much geared at supplying cheaper primary food products to those who are currently hungry, the billion who are hungry, but is more locked into a logic of the food industry that serves the agro industry, enables it to differentiate these products and charge a premium for it. Putting on the market products, sometimes of questionable nutritional quality, but basically targeting the growing middle class that Mr. Malone was referring to last night. So I was wondering what other strategies by Syngenta Foundation or other groups, similar groups, you may have heard of, that are catering to the needs of that billion people outside of the logic of the large-scale food industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to say something about Syngenta Foundation's strategy. We basically support two types of activities. The first is advanced crop science, and I'm getting back to the R&D in crop science, and I'm getting back to that in a minute. And the second one is projects on the ground that basically run and do agricultural extension in order to improve, mostly through agronomic improvements and some purchased inputs as appropriate to that particular setting, improve livelihoods on the farms, both through the intensification of food crops as well as the production or the introduction of cash crops. Both are needed for food security at the micro level. Now, the strategies with respect to the proprietary technologies, I think that we have to look at something that I would call the additive progression of technology and services needs in agriculture, starting from very low subsistence level sort of production conditions to advanced, more sophisticated production conditions that are typically, by definition, also more more commercial. And I think that at low levels of livelihood, resource-poor farmers is not proprietary technology that is going to necessarily make the difference there and or is the right response. What is the right response is improved agronomy, improved, and that requires knowledge and the transfer, the transmission of knowledge, which again requires, by definition, something like extension services. Number one, and as far as the inputs on the seed side are concerned, it requires better, more robust, open pollinating varieties that typically come out of the public sector research programs. At higher levels of capability, you would add more inputs that can include crop protection inputs. It certainly will include fertilizer at some point, because if you look at the way nutrients are being depleted in soils in the settings that we're talking about, you've got to do something to replace nutrients, and that is fertilization. You can try to do it organically if you have enough manure and biomass in order to do it, but typically because of poverty you don't have it, so fertilizer is the more economical and feasible solution. Crop protection products can be very important also. You can, at some higher levels of sophistication, introduce GMOs, for example, and that way you can, if you have BT products where you have insect resistance plants, then that way you can save on sprayings. But otherwise, if you want to harvest, oftentimes you have to spray, and then the issue is safe and effective use of agrochemicals.
Thank you. Thank you. Does anybody else would like to? Okay. So, thank you very much. I want to thank you first, all of you, for your participation. It was great. I think that the conferences this morning and also the question period showed very clearly that agricultural development is a very complex issue, and that we cannot have simple solutions for complex issues. So investment would be badly needed to be able to tackle those complex solutions. And I would like to finish by thanking our speakers that did an excellent job and had a very great presentation. Thank you very much.